Hello, fellow travelers, and welcome to the Traversing the Stars podcast. How are my loyal listeners? Thank you for your continued support. And as always, smash the subscribe button, everybody. We have an amazing show for you all because boarding the mothership is Tom Constantino. You know him as the editor and co-producer of The Orville. Now come join me as we go traversing the stars. Well, hello, Mr. Constantino. Thank you so much for coming to the Traversing the Stars podcast.
Hello. How's it going?
Oh, it's going very well. Like I said, I'm loving The Orville. Me and my wife, we watch it all the time. It's like must-see television.
I'll send the check.
Please do. I could probably use it at this point.
Me too.
So what inspired you to pursue a career in entertainment, and who were your earliest influences?
Who were my earliest influences? Oh, wow. That's we're going deep. Probably like everyone else, you know, I was a Star Wars guy. I was a Star Trek guy. So I, you know, I think I actually really wanted to be an astronaut to start, but, you know, I had like random movies that I found amazing. I probably saw The Godfather really too young, and I saw a lot of this, the Burt Reynolds action movies a little too young. So like Hooper and things like that. And I always thought, I was like enthralled by the process of filmmaking and stunts. So, I had a very non-securitous route to getting to here, but you know, I mean, I liked everything from like weird movies to like Witness with Harrison Ford to, you know, The Wizard of Oz. Like I just absorb cinema. So,
So your career started mostly as an editor. So yeah. You also went to Ithaca College. That's where you learned editing, or was editing an offshoot? Okay. So what were those classes like?
Well, there weren't actually classes, actually. Well, sorry, I'm scratching my leg. There were classes, but I actually learned most of my editing. They had video editing systems set up in these little bays across along the hallways. And I worked on the television station, ICTV. And I actually learned there was a Sony three-quarter editing system with three decks called the Sony 900 that I just sort of practiced on. I mean, obviously, we learned on a Steenbeck and all that other stuff, but most of my editing skills came from kind of teaching myself to shoot, to work on the TV station.
Now, the cool thing about editing, and I don't know about you, but I think editors don't always get the credit they deserve about how impactful they are in the show, the movies they're a part of. But editors are also part of the storyteller. Is that correct? You guys are helping to determine what fits, what doesn't fit, how much of a certain scene needs to be cut or not cut. So how does understanding the editing part of it help you become a better storyteller?
You mean in terms of the technological part of editing?
Technological part of editing, and also the decision-making part of editing process.
I always wanted to work with my hands, and I kind of couldn't figure out any other way to do it. I'm an incredibly mediocre artist. Like, I kind of can cartoon sort of, but not enough to like make a living at. And somehow this felt the most tangible way to be physically active in the creative filmic process. So, you know, my hands in the machines and pointing to my avid, which you can't see here, but that's kind of how that happened. It sort of evolved that it was my physical way. I had to kind of do it myself. So editing seemed the most natural course into the filmmaking / artistic process. And then, you know, I think I wanted to be in the director's chair for a while, maybe, but just, you know, it just 30 years go by or 20 years go by or whatever, and suddenly you're just doing the thing you're doing and you get good at it, and you know, people know you for that thing. So
how does the editing decision making process work when you have a cut of a film or show? How are you determining when to make your cut, when to put in a scene or remove a scene for a particular show or movie? Is the director in the room? Is the writer in the room?
It depends on what you're working on. I mean, like, you know, most scripted shows, editors get a first pass, basically. So, you know, most of I've been fortunate enough, especially with Seth and some of the people I've worked with, that they value editors' opinions. So, you know, we're sort of the third part of writing. You know, you can have the loftiest of plans on set and in the writing room, but when you get into the edit room, that's where you have to sort of figure out, you know, the movie you plan to make and the movie you made are now have to reconcile with each other. So You kind of feel it in your gut. You kind of know how something is going to work, or you kind of have a feeling how it could work, or you know something's broken with the story. You kind of know where it needs to be, but you're in part A of how it would get there, and you know somehow you reverse engineer getting to the place where you know it needs to be, and figuring out how to build the scene or tell the story to get there. It's sort of a, since I've been doing it so long, it's sort of an organic thing. It's like this weird feeling I get in my gut if I know something's supposed to work or not work. So, and I can be persuaded, by the way. It's not, you know. I
mean, have you ever had a good argument with the director or whatever on what should or not be in a editing? And what did it come down to when you finally made the final decision? Was it purpose of the story? Was it length?
Oh, sometimes, I mean, luckily we're not dealing with length. I mean, sometimes, you know, I've lost some battles that were smart, and I've lost some battles that I, to this day, I wish the version I was correct. <You know? laughs> Well, what are you going to do? I mean, it doesn't really matter in the end. I mean, it's a subjective process, but I think everybody's usually trying to all go in the same direction to make the best product possible. So you end up sometimes having a lot of conversations, or if somebody's really strict in their vision and sometimes they're a few steps ahead, I'm not talking about Seth or anybody in particular, but sometimes you have to sort of like leap of faith that they're the ones who wrote it. They're the ones who birthed it from them, and they have some sort of thing in their head that they want to manifest, and they may know it even better than you. You're there to sort of like be their gut check.
Now, because you are slightly, maybe I might be wrong on this, but slightly on the outside, in other words, you're not the one who directed that piece of film. You're not necessarily the writer. Do you have a more objective view of the story than maybe the director or writer would have looking at it?
Yes, in theory. I mean, a lot of good directors and a lot of good writers are able to basically divorce themselves from it. And most of the most successful ones do, but yeah, I'm coming in pure and clean. Eventually I get tainted as well. You know, I can sort of see the material too long, and then, even I lose my objectivity. But the whole point of an editor, well, there's a lot of points of an editor, but one of the main points is to bring some sort of like clear, new, fresh perspective to the material and, sort of be the, I think I sort of said it before, but like the truth teller, like, you don't need this scene. You know, it would be great here. Or, you know, here's some connective thematic thing we didn't think about. Even these scenes were separate. There's a way to intercut them so they now have a bigger meaning.
Mm. So when you're at the editing stage, has the part that you're editing, has that been scored and added to CGI effects, or this pre-CGI, pre-scoring when you're doing your editing?
Oh, it's pre-CGI, pre-everywhere. I'm cutting with blue screens. Well, pre-vis sometimes, you know, which are rudimentary visual effects that come from the visual effect department that even I sometimes get to have a say in, depending on the project, and maybe they'll do a different version of it. But no, we're in the very rudimentary stage. Scoring, all that happens after. Like, we have to get the story together and attached, and then we take that finished, effectively locked cut. And some things are happening in tandem, but the locked cut is what we then build the score and some of the visual effects off of. So I'm the first line of defense.
I like,
me and my cohorts.
I like that idea. So when you're trying to do your editing, you're developing the story, a lot of the sweetening of a show or a movie is in the scoring and also in the special effects. So how are you able to kind of imagine what is kind of happening without the extra little sweeteners that the viewer enjoys and goes, yeah, you can tell that's dramatic. You have the dramatic music, you have the happy, funny music or whatever. You don't have any of that. So how are you visualizing that in your head of what's supposed to?
I have a pretty big imagination, but part of it is that if the story works without those things, which is what's really important, if you're telling an engaging thing before it has all that in, then you know you're going to be fine when all the rest of the stuff comes in. It's either going to stay lateral or elevated. So, you know, we do use temp score, and we do, you know, sometimes there's some temporary effects, like I said, like the previs. You know, we do have an idea of what the ships are going to look like, but you know, if you are telling a compelling story when it's so rudimentary and people are into the end, you're going to be good. You know, you can only get better, especially with our VFX on our show and our team and our composers. And you know, we those are two departments that are beyond amazing. So they're going to bring it no matter what, even if the story lacks.
Well, I mean, the Orville has been absolutely killing it. And if my memory serves on my research, you started off as an editor, but now you've moved up to producer or executive producer. Is that correct?
Oh, thank you. Everyone, no. No, co-producer.
Co-producer.
No, but I'm still editing basically too. It's I just have several other hats and that encompasses it. And I'm on set a bunch, at least when it comes to the Orville, and cutting and editing is my true love. And that's where I'm most known for. And obviously we had a team of editors that I were supervising, who also helped shape all the stories and stuff, because these were massive, these were 60, 70, 80 minute movies basically.
Mm. So how did you first get involved with Seth MacFarlane and the Orville? And what did you think about the concept when he first came to you with it?
Oh, he didn't come to me, but someone I had worked with on another show, who became the post producer of this, recommended me, and I had to go through a bunch of interviews. My first interview was with Brannon, and then, it was with Seth and Jon Favreau. And I think we bonded over, the love of Star Trek and also sort of understanding the values. And, also I thought the script was funny, and I kind of knew where the rest of the season was going. And, I'm a big sci-fi nerd. So I just telepathically willed my way into this job somehow. It's kind of how it happened. But I kind of knew from the beginning it was going to be something sort of special. So, and different, especially once I knew, because the pilot is obviously very joke-handed, but once I started seeing the other outlines and scripts, I was like, oh, I see where this is going. Okay. I'm going to try and join up for this ride.
So when you were first looking at the Orville, like you said, I think the initial notion of the show when people first heard about it was that it was like a satire of Star Trek.
Right.
And that's, I think, lasted an episode or maybe even two episodes before people started realizing they took a hard turn away from that and became something of its own.
Yeah.
So when you first were hearing about the story, did you first think this is a Star Trek satire, or did you already know how deep they were going to go into the world that they were creating?
Well, like I said, I saw the pilot and I kind of was, it was never Family Guy in space, but it was the closest thing to what people called it, Family Guy in space. But I immediately was able, the indications of where they wanted to go was in the interviews and in the discussions. And then very quickly after I signed on, or after I was about to sign on, I got access to the rest of the material. And that's when it really solidified me to know that we were doing. I mean, I kind of went in a leap of faith, because obviously, I respected all the creators on the show and, because of their long histories and stuff. So I kind of had a feeling this was going to be something a little different. So once again, it's like that gut thing,
So when do you think the Orville found its voice and became a singular thing, divided or separate from people calling it the Star Trek joke, satire,
I think it's still evolving, actually. I mean, I think it's sort of, everyone says about a girl, but it's harder for me because, like, once again, I knew the scripts. So I feel like from the second episode, which was actually the Bioship episode, which got moved to fourth because I think Fox was nervous about it, but it turned out to be a great episode. So I kind of knew it was sort of starting to fire on different cylinders and trying to become its own thing. So I think really early on, the first couple of scripts, for me personally, it was Priya, because I cut that and I also thought that was, real sci-fi concepts. And, there's a lot of jokes and a lot of comedy, but like, I also felt like that's when some of the interpersonal relationship really started to build in. And that's when I felt like, okay, we're starting to get multi-layered. And another one that I love is Into the Fold, but I know some people love that episode, some people love it less, but I think Isaac with the two kids, I thought that was like a kind of a game changer. And of course, About a Girl and all that other stuff, but I think where the show became the show, I think those were the episodes for me.
So as the show shifted in tone, no worries, it's totally fine. Everyone's why I do the thing with my eyes too, where they kind of do twitchy.
No, they're dry. You can leave this in. I don't care if everybody knows that my eyes are dry.
It's totally okay. I don't think there's gonna be like comments in the comment section. Why is his eyes
dry? You never know.
if people want to comment on anything ridiculous, go right ahead. I enjoy the attention.
That asshole's wearing his hat again. He's wearing that dumb hat and he didn't shave.
That's totally all right. As the editor, did how you approach editing an episode change as the tone changed?
No, because as crazy as it sounds, I when scenes were comedy, we would cut them like comedy. When scenes were dramatic, we would cut them dramatically. Like we, you know, we've always been able to adapt to tone. So the only thing that being on Hulu and not having to deal with the 40-second clock, the 42-minute clock, is that we're allowed to, you know, let visual effects expand more. If we want to have a moment with the score, we can let the score play. We don't have to cut every character. Like, characters can sometimes have time to react in real time, which is what a lot of streaming shows do. Mm-hmm. You tend to make those sacrifices sometimes on network television. Everybody thinks really fast. And it's, you know, in a case like This Is Us, well, maybe that's an example, like West Wing, where it's like the snappy thing works. On other shows, it's the compression of real time just to fit it, get the whole damn story in before the ending. So, you know, it did affect us in that way, that we got to sort of, you know, be more movie quality, movie-like in our expansiveness and storytelling pacing. But how we cut the show and how we thought of it and how we evolved, that's been there since the beginning. Editing is editing.
Well, I think me and a lot of viewers view the end of season two is one of the most ballsy moments in television. I mean, I've watched a lot of TV, you know, a lot of sci-fi shows, Star Trek, you know, Discovery, all those stuff. But I feel like what Orville did at the end of season two was ballsy as hell. Not only because of the battle itself with Kalen, which must have been expensive as all hell to produce, but what you did with Isaac, I don't think I think of a main character of a primary series that takes that level of risk with one of their primary characters, like Orville did.
Well, that was all the writers. It was all Seth. You know, it's also when it, you know, I remember there was like a space.com article that was like, the Orville evolved into itself. And that was where it sort of became its own. It's really its own beast. And I like that, you know, that redemption of Isaac is, you know, going to be an ever continuing thing, because he did basically help kill off thousands of people.
Yeah.
Even if it was accidentally. So, I think there's some, you know, the problem is that, and I feel like even with, like, in the case of Star Trek or, you know, like The Expanse or Us and stuff, is that sometimes I feel like there's some really good storytelling work being done, but because it's not the zeitgeist show and defined zeitgeist, you know, that sometimes some of the work gets overlooked. You know, there's some great work being done on shows that look, they're popular, you know, people love them. I'm not complaining about it, but there's some shows that, like, they get pegged as the zeitgeist show, and they can do a lot of bad storytelling, or they can make some really, what are risky moves, but they're actually bad storytelling, but they'll get lauded for it. And then it's, God forbid, you know, like The Expanse or Strange New Worlds, or, you know, I mean, Picard or something does something that's a little, you know, off the reservation, and suddenly it's getting lambasted. That's not the best example, but I'm saying is that, like, sometimes like things, shows get prejudged as to their storytelling ability and quality. And I think sometimes, you know, there's good shows, good episodes that get overlooked that are stand toe to toe with the other anointed episodes. Mm. If that makes any sense.
Yeah. I mean, I think a lot of shows, especially the bigger the show, not just financially, but bigger for popularity. And same thing with comic books as well, are afraid to change the character, like the guy. Yeah. You know, they don't take that kind of risk and say, we're going to tell you where the character is going to go, instead of, this is what you like, we're going to give it to you. And I thought the Orville really did it to Isaac, when they were like, now deal with it. What are you guys going to do about it? We just made a major change to the character. When that was I was wondering, when that was first happening, were the discussions in the editing room of whether or not they thought the fans would ever accept Isaac again? Was there some actual discussion of worry that maybe something, you know, a favorite character was kind of going to get fans to resent what they did? I mean, what were those discussions like?
I think the discussions were after that. I think because the battle scaled up so big and it was sort of such a hit, that I think focusing in on Isaac's, the repercussions of the battle became more of a thing once we saw the audience reaction to it. I think it was always ingrained into the storytelling, but you know, it's sort of the battle and the whole thing sort of took on a life of its own and people's reaction to it. So I think we pivoted a little bit to sort of embrace the ramifications, thereby more of the tone, not even tone, but more of the more of what that looks like when utopia goes through a life altering experience. So that included Isaac. So I think it didn't necessarily happen while we were shooting it, but once it was edited and on the air, that's when I think the real pivot began.
So in season three, you introduced a new character, Ensign Charlie Burke, who in the first episode, her primary role was to kind of aid Isaac. Was she brought in as a audience surrogate at that point to kind of voice what a segment of the audience would maybe be feeling at that moment about Isaac?
I think that's really probably the writers can answer that better than me. I think she was brought in because, you know, John got to be head of engineering and they needed someone good on the bridge. And I do think there is an element that having, I think you're right. Yes. I think some of it was to serve that idea that there's consequences for people's actions, but I also think it was more to also fill in that very important chair. So it was sort of like a dual purpose. And Charlie's going to get some good things to do coming up. You know, we still got six episodes to go. So there will be more to her story.
So are they going to, I mean, so she'll be developed further. Like I said, a lot of the early episodes is her kind of being somewhat of a rogue individual on that bridge. Is she going to come back to the herd?
Yeah, I mean, there will be continuing development of her character. Leave it that way. But there'll be more stuff where, you know, they get to focus on her, but also, you know, she did take a big chunk of 301. So, you know, they have to spread the love around and let other characters be there. And so it's not just going to be the Charlie Burke show, but there will be other opportunities for her to show her worth and her abilities.
So in your opinion, how important was that first episode of season three where the whole episode kind of is a examination of Isaac and his role? Was that something that you felt everyone kind of felt had to be done that first episode, or was that just part of the allegory that they were developing about the fight and the conflict and the acceptance of the character?
I think it was one of those things that I think the writers and Seth, I think that they realized that in season two to three, that needed to be, you know, once again, needed to be addressed in a more significant fashion. I think it was always going to sort of be there, but I think that's, they wanted to sort of like reset the clock and the repercussions. And then weirdly, the pandemic sort of helped create this aura of time passing. You know, it sort of ended up paralleling real life. So I think the episode has probably more impact now that we've been through 2.5 years of this stuff than it would have been if it came out like, you know, a year later kind of thing. So, but yeah, I think that, you know, that needed to be told and also helped set off some things in season three. And also sort of, you know, they wanted to revitalize the look a little. So I think that's what that episode was, basically a reset to new network and relaunch.
Yeah, I mean, I must say it's really interesting that it feels like when it moved over to Hulu, the show kind of exploded in maybe budget and scale. I mean, there's episodes that look almost movie quality on the Orville since it moved over to Hulu. I mean, was that an effort, you know, when they moved over to Hulu, like, we're going to prove that Fox screwed up and not letting us on, we're going to put everything we have into this?
Well, Fox didn't screw. I mean, are you saying the Fox didn't cancel? That's one of those rumor things. Seth wanted to have more expansive storytelling and be able to take his time with production. And this was all, that's one of those like weird rumors that just like seems to keep bouncing around. Fox did not cancel. This was a mutual, you know, everybody's friends kind of thing. So, you know, that's in order for Seth to be able to tell these more expansive stories, Hulu became a better fit. But there was no like, we're done with you. Like Fox wanted it, at least, you know, with the conversations I was in on, Fox wanted it, but they, you know, they have a broadcast model they need to adhere to, and they need it in a certain amount of time. So, you know, they let him do this.
Are there things that can be done on Hulu with the show that maybe when it was on network, it would have been considered too risky?
I think there's probably some minor censorship stuff, but, you know, we didn't really change our, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, there's a couple of curses that are just probably we probably could have skirted and maybe got away with on network. And, you know, but there's not, you know, the expansive amount of time and the not commercial breaks and the binging aspect of it, or like, you know, the streaming aspect of it is what has changed, but the show is still the show. And, you know, probably we could have written these scripts just much shorter on Fox. So,
well, I think when the best episodes you've ever done happened to be the most recent one, Gently Falling Rain, which was so well done. I mean, that was such a smart show. Yeah. It's a fantastic allegory. I'm not sure if I'm reading too much into what the allegory represents, though. I kind of think it has to do with the current political arena that we live in.
It was written 3.5 years ago. I'm just saying it's written. This is the thing. It's one of those
really
things, when you write evergreen stories. Yes, it was written in 2019.
Wow. Okay. I wouldn't have thought that. I figured it was a lot more recent than that.
Nope. That is the amazing talent of my, I believe Seth wrote that. Well, maybe Andre. I mean, they all wrote. I mean, Andre and Brandon did it, but like that is talented sci-fi Star Trek, good writer veterans who can tell an evergreen allegory.
Well, I would definitely say the political situation in the 2019, 2018 era wasn't so much different either.
It wasn't so much different, but I'm saying is that like, it's like, if someone thinks it's like, you know, the last 6 months or recent events, or you know good stories are evergreen, at least my favorite stories are. I mean, sometimes maybe the effects look dated, or you know, the music choices or something, but is the story relatively evergreen? That's the stuff that's important to me.
How important do you think it is that the show does hold up an allegorical mirror to the society that it looks at? I mean, I know you're saying it's not directly about one incident or a time period, but it does actively exist as allegorical to, generally speaking, to society and politics, everything like that.
I think it's important for something to have longevity. I think sometimes you can watch an old episode of you can watch an old sitcom from the 90s and they're like making jokes that are like pop culture references, and you barely remember half of them, you know. And our show does some of that stuff too, but is the core of the story something that's like, you know, something that's meaningful to generation after generation? And that I think that's important to keep a show's legacy going. Also, like, you don't always have to, like, and I'm not picking on any other show, but it's like hit people over the head with a direct message. It's okay to, I think the viewer doing some work to add their own fill in the blanks as to the narrative we're trying to tell, it helps them enjoy the process more. You're not doing it all for them.
In your opinion, do you think the Orville views this audience as being more intelligent than a lot of other shows maybe view the audience as much?
No. I mean, yeah, I think we are very blessed with intelligent fans and the ones I've interacted with, and a good audience and a good head on their shoulders, and probably the nicest fan base we have a pretty sharp bunch, but I would never condescend to think that we're smarter. There's some pretty smart people making some pretty smart TV and watching some pretty smart TV. And, you know, I would never, never say that. You know, I feel very blessed, but, you know, I hope we have smart people watching. And even if we have people, what may be classified as dumb people watching, if they're nice and they enjoy it, cool. That's cool too. our group's pretty sharp. Even our detractors are sharp. So.
So when Orbit moved over to Hulu, it changed. It got a subtitle, New Horizons.
Yeah.
Now, is New Horizons, I'm obviously, it references being on Hulu versus, you know, it's that change. But how deep does that subtitle go into the viewpoint of the show in the third season?
I think it was just more just to sort of give it, I mean, like, this, once again, this would be Seth and the writers, but I think it was just to give it more of an expansive feel, and also to delineate it, or, you know, to separate out on Hulu. But yeah, I guess it's sort of like a wink to the new expansive nature of it, and some new adventures, you know. And also, I think being off the air for 3 years, it felt like it needed a little bit of an extra punch. So that's kind of where, I don't think there was like a you know, like some Machiavellian plan. So, you know, some of these things that seem like that they're like nefarious or like well planned out, and sort of like, oh, well, maybe we should do that. Sometimes that happens a lot. Oh, that'd be a good idea, you know. And then people start describing these like big, not you, but like these like big backstories to things.
I mean, as you said, the show was off for 3 years. Are you surprised that the audience came back so readily? I mean, was there a concern with the time difference that people would start forgetting about it?
Oh, yeah. That's why I kept my big mouth open for 3 years on Twitter. No. I mean, I'm so grateful that, you know, I mean, whoever left is fine. I get it. And whoever didn't leave, I appreciate it. No, it's, you know, it was a long 3 years. So
it felt like that as a fan. We're like, where's my orb?
It's fine. I don't blame it. We were saying the same thing. We're working here. We're like, oh, someday we'll get to all see it on the air. That'd be great. Or whatever you call it now, streaming. Mm. No one went in and said in May or whenever, like, we were starting to gear up, you know, we didn't really shoot till October, but like, no one was like, oh, I hope this comes out in the middle of the decade.
So, I mean, how much of that was because of COVID? What was some of the other reason that
it was a lot of it was COVID and also the expansive nature of the episodes. I mean, it was always going to be a longer timeline, but I think it probably would have been probably closer to 16 or 18 months versus, you know, 34 or whatever it was, 32, you know what I mean? So we picked up a year and a little more, but we would have in the end, we probably would have, you know, the latest spring 2021 or winter 2021, we would have really realistically dropped all in.
Hypothetically speaking, there was a fourth season of The Orville, would there be a similar time frame before it between seasons 3 and 4 as there were between 2 and 3?
I'll be dead. I won't know. I'll be old. Don't look at me. No, I don't know. That's going to be up to the fates. You know, obviously there's some Ted in between that needs to be dealt with. But it depends on the bandwidth and the appetite and, you know, how quickly scripts could get written and all that other stuff. But I could see it being long, but not as long.
So, I mean, there's obviously a lot of rumors about season 4, and I know this is something, a lot of things you probably can't say about it, and that's totally fine.
Yeah.
But there's some rumors, without getting too specific, where certain individuals are saying, seems to be some rumors that are saying they're not going to come back. They wouldn't come back. Some say they would.
You're talking about another dumb article about Seth.
That's what I'm talking about. So no. can you put that to bed?
Yeah, it's ridiculous. And I've said it. I said on Twitter, I'll say it here. No, it's ridiculous. No. Seth is the Orville. No, the Orville goes wherever Seth goes. That is not what's happening. Not at all.
So we're not talking. So there is potentially open discussion about a potential for if the ratings, everything else hold up.
Yeah. I've been completely honest. It's all TBD. It's like, I really don't have any horse in this race. I mean, like, I would love to do another season. I think Seth would love to do another season. A lot of people would, but it's, you know, like, this has been a fun ride. And if it ends here, it ends here. Like, I'm just being honest. Like, Seth is the Orville.
As a fan of the Orville, I'm sure all the fans are happy to hear that. And like I said, it's nice that you put that rumor to bed, because there's a lot of Facebook groups that are posting that article over and over again.
No, and I get it, and it's fine, but it's like, it's just not true. If you are actually, I'm not saying, like, there's a lot of things you can sort of guess and extrapolate. If you know the show and have done your history, you know that the Orville is Seth. So, and we got a lot of great people who work here and care about it, but like, this is his baby, and he would never abandon it like that.
So what kind of things can listeners look forward to season 3?
What kind of things?
What can we look forward to for season 3?
You mean like other storylines?
Like big events? Are we going to see your big battles? Are we going to see a lot
there's,
of more?
There's going to be lots. I wish I could talk. There's going to be a lot more stuff coming up. We're just getting into the good stuff. There's a lot of character-driven stuff coming up too, which is good. But there'll be more space expensiveness.
Is there going to be more Bordas and Clyden by any chance?
Yeah, of course. There's going to be more of everybody. There will be more. Everybody you know and love will get their screen time.
All right, very cool. Mr. Constantino.
And maybe some people you won't love too, but you know.
I was a little surprised, concerned about Clyden, because on the IDM Pro, they showed him stopping at the 2019, but no current episode. So I was really worried if is he not coming back or not.
Just stay tight.
All right. Well, Mr. Constantino, it was a great pleasure talking with you, sir. I love talking to the Orville, and it's like an honor speaking with you.
You as well, always.